Well, today is the last day that we are going to be covering the book of Micah before we start our summer teaching series next week. And this morning we're going to be exploring a text that spans chapter 3 and chapter 4. And I'm hoping that the passage we look at is going to be able to tie together a lot of what we've looked at in the last month. We started a month ago today with an orientation to the book, getting to know Micah, getting to know his times, the history and the geography and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things we talked about is, what is a prophet? And what is the experience of the prophet? What is it like to, what does it feel like to be a prophet? Does anybody remember, what does it feel like to be a prophet? Is it a pleasant experience? No? Why? Prophets don't generally have good news. They generally have unpleasant things to say, and if you are not a prophet and all this guy ever seems to say is unpleasant things, how do you feel about him? Not so good. You kind of make life not so good for him. So prophets tend to be lonely because they see what God sees and they feel what God feels, and as a result they're critical of the world around them. And they're scandalized by the things that the world takes for granted. This morning I want to kind of take that and go in a slightly different direction and ask, what is it that a prophet does? What is a prophet trying to accomplish? You could say he writes, He foretells the future because he remembers the past. Whenever the prophet talks about the future, it's always because he remembers what God said in the past. He's trying to bring people to an awareness. So what exactly is it? What's the thing? What's the goal? Not just for Micah, but for any prophet. Well, there's been a very influential book by an Old Testament scholar named Walter Brueggemann. I've been very influenced by him. Seminal work called The Prophetic Imagination. It's only about 120 pages, but unless you're really into Old Testament prophets, it's probably not what you're going to want to spend your time on. But he says that prophets have essentially two tasks. And I have rephrased them for us because he uses kind of technical language. So I'm just kind of adapting it. I just want to give credit where credit's due. So two tasks of the prophet. The first prophetic task, and you can see this on your handout, is to penetrate the moral numbness of those who accept the status quo by publicly expressing the pain of God and others. The first task is to penetrate the moral numbness of those who accept the status quo by publicly expressing the pain of God and others. What do you suppose is meant by that phrase, moral numbness? What do you think that's talking about? I heard America and I heard the way things are now. What does it mean to be morally numb? No regard for what is good or what's right. It's a kind of complacency, a kind of indifference about the morality of what you're doing. It is apathy about the effect that your choices have on other people or on creation. Because as long as you have enough to eat, you remember the prophets who, as long as they have something to nibble, to nashak, to charge interest, as long as they have something to eat, they say peace, but they declare war against him who puts nothing in their mouths. Morally numb people are those who, as long as they have enough to eat, they don't care. It's a deadness, a lack of sensitivity. And moral numbness is particularly characteristic of people who accept the status quo. Now, what kind of people are most likely to accept the status quo? The rich and influential. The people who benefit from the status quo. Who benefit from the way that the world works. In Israel, just like in any society, there are some people during Micah's time who are quite happy with how things are, and there are some people who are not happy with how things are. And so in Micah, it's the bankers, it's the judges, it's the prophets, it's the wealthy and powerful. In Jesus' day, it'd be the Sadducees. The Sadducees absolutely benefit from the way that things are arranged. And so the job of the prophet is to penetrate that moral numbness of people who accept the way things are because they benefit from it. And how does the prophet penetrate that moral numbness? I've already told you. You already have it written down. By expressing the pain of God and others. They speak for God, and they speak for the wounded to the people who are asleep at the wheel. That's what prophets do. You think that you're insulated. You trust in your wealth, or you trust in your alliances with Egypt, or whatever. And man, Egypt is a broken reed that's going to pierce your hand if you try to lean on it. So, this is the first task, is to try and wake people up out of this moral complacency, a numbness, lack of sensitivity, by insisting on the pain that it causes. The second prophetic task is to help others to imagine a new alternative reality that will arise due to God's faithfulness. The second prophetic task is to help others to imagine a new alternative reality that will arise due to God's faithfulness. The job of the prophet is not to bring about change, or to reorder society, or to punish wrongdoing. The job of the prophet is simply to help people imagine that the world could be different than it is. Why do you suppose imagining is such an important task for prophets? Yeah, they're people who are benefiting from the way that the world is arranged. They have no incentive to think of anything else. And the people who are not benefiting, the people who are being extracted from or whatever, they have trouble imagining because, how do I put this? It's like the song by John Mayer, "Waiting on the World to Change," where he says, "We see the system, we see how the system works. We just feel like we don't have the power to change anything, and so we're just waiting." And so the act of imagining sort of infuses life and possibility. And that possibility, the prophet then doesn't have to do anything. He can sort of step aside, and that possibility is going to do its work in the hearts and minds of the people. So, the prophet will say, if nothing changes, we're headed in this direction, but things could go in this other direction, and in fact, they're going to go in this other direction. And why is that new alternative future going to come about? You already wrote it down. Because God is faithful. It's not going to happen because humans are repentant, or because humans obey, or because of human effort or merit. It will happen for no other reason than the God of Israel is faithful. And out of his faithfulness, newness is going to come about. So in the text today, we're going to look at chapter 3, verse 9 through chapter 4, verse 5. And we're going to see Micah is doing both of these things. He's penetrating the moral numbness of those who accept the status quo by publicly expressing the pain of God and others. And he is helping others to imagine a new alternative reality that arises due to God's faithfulness. How are we doing? It's kind of a heady beginning, but I think maybe that'll be helpful. And I wanted you to have it in handout form because I think that'll be helpful even if you're not reading Micah. The next time you're reading any of the prophets, you can be looking which of these tasks is Jeremiah doing right now, or Hosea, or whoever. All right, so let's look at chapter 3, 9 through 12. This whole thing, it might be one oracle, it might be two oracles that are like put together, but the net result is it's one continuous read. So we're going to see Micah accuse the morally numb people of three different sins. Three things he's accusing them of. So we're going to read through this, see if you can notice them. Hear this, you heads of the house of Israel, and of the rulers of the house of Israel, who detest justice and make crooked all that is straight, who build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. Its heads give judgment for a bribe, its priests teach for a price, and its prophets practice divination for money. Yet they lean on the Lord and say, is not the Lord in the midst of us? No disaster shall come upon us. Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. All right, what did you notice? They're not just. That's the first accusation, injustice. He accuses them of being unjust. They detest it. They make crooked what is straight. They build Zion with blood. And we've already seen that as we've gone through Micah for the last month. We talked about predatory investing, predatory housing practices. We've seen judges who do the brother-in-lawing thing, and they're taking bribes. They're chopping people up like meat for the pot. They're denying justice to those who need it. We've already seen this. In verses 9 and 10, we're not seeing anything new that Micah hasn't already said. So that's one sin. Are there any other sins that you notice? What else does he accuse them of? War? You think in the building Zion with blood? Is that where you're getting that? I think building Zion with blood is probably a reference to injustice, maybe like slave labor. When you look at verse 11, the heads give judgment for a bribe, the priests teach for a price, the prophets practice divination for money. It's money. What do we call money-related sins? Greed. So the second accusation is affluence built on greed. And he doesn't mention the affluence here, but that's a summary of what he's been doing the whole time in the whole book. Micah is writing in a period of economic growth prosperity and opportunism. It's a period of affluence, but that affluence is concentrated among the few. You have the few who live in Jerusalem, and not even everyone in Jerusalem, and they have all of the money and the wealth and the power, and then all of the farmers who live outside of the city, they've got nothing because they're constantly having to feed whatever wealth they have into the city. So Micah accuses them of greed. And we've already come across this. Right? This is like a summary of what we've already seen. They've committed injustices, not because they hated people, but because it was profitable. Injustice is generally profitable. And Micah knows that affluence and prosperity do not signal God's endorsement. The third accusation. Can anybody tease out what that third accusation is? We're in chapter 3, verse 11. It's the way that they treat God, right? God is with us, regardless of how we behave. So the way that I put that is they're treating God as a resource. But resource may not be the right word. If you think of a better word, you go ahead and write a different word down. But the idea is the kings, the judges, the prophets and the priests, the people who are at the top, they are all on the take. And they all practice injustice, and they build Zion with blood, and then they turn to the camera and say, "And God bless America." This kind of God always will endorse. God is always with us. God is very manageable and predictable, and he's with us no matter what. And Micah is like, no. No. Why is this a problem for them to lean on the Lord and say, "Well, the Lord is in our midst. No disaster will come on us." Why is that a problem? Like they're mocking God a little bit? Because what? Hypocritical? You know, what does it say about God if they're right? That he's not just. He doesn't care. He doesn't hear. He doesn't see. And he's very stagnant, manageable. But God is not stagnant and manageable. This kind of view of God denies God his freedom. And the freedom to rage and the freedom to abandon. His presence, his absence is not noticed by the people who have enough to eat. And then you come to verse 12, after all these accusations, and verse 12 begins with the word, therefore. And what Brueggemann says is that anytime you come across the word therefore in the prophets, you want to duck. Because whatever is coming after the word therefore, it's like they'll label what's wrong, and then they'll describe what's going to happen, and they connect it with therefore. So it's always introducing consequences. Consequences. So, verse 12, therefore, because of you, Zion will be plowed as a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. This is not the first time that we've come across consequences. We've hit on consequences basically every week, I think. Maybe not the first week when we did just orientation. But the predatory investors, they're going to be homeless. The prophets who preach for a price, they're not going to have visions anymore. The powerful people who ignore the cries of the vulnerable are going to have their cries ignored. Sacrifice is going to accomplish nothing. So we've come across consequences. And here, Micah names the main consequence, the one that encompasses all of the others. And that's the destruction of Jerusalem. That's what he was telling people in chapter 1 to wail and grieve about. You remember in chapter 1 when he has the list of all of the town names that we've never heard of? And he says, roll in the dust, Beth Laafra, because of the disaster that's coming. And you over in Lachish, hitch up the chariots because disaster's coming. He sees what happened in the north. And he grieves because the same thing is going to happen to his own people in the south. And then he tells these villages in the south to grieve and to get ready. And to get ready for this, verse 12, the destruction of the city. All right, how are we doing? We're making good time, so any thoughts or questions up to this point? Do we see how these four verses are working to penetrate the moral numbness of those who accept the status quo by publicly expressing the pain of God and others? You see how these four verses are accomplishing that task or executing that task? All right. Well, we come now to the second prophetic tasks, to help others to imagine a new alternative reality that will arise due to God's faithfulness. Verse 1 of chapter 4. It shall come to pass in the latter days. In the latter days. And then he goes on to describe for the next several verses what this new alternative future is going to be. But this is a really abrupt transition. He just all of a sudden starts describing something completely different. And it's like he's saying, I don't know how this is going to happen. I don't know when it's going to happen. But in God's faithfulness, this is going to happen. As we read through verses 1 through 4, we might think, well, that's not very realistic. But the question is not whether these verses are practical, but whether they are imaginable. Remember, the job of the prophet is not to tell you what's practical. His job is to help people imagine a new reality. Did you know practicality is not a fruit of the Spirit? Pragmatism is not a gift of the Spirit. Practicality is not a virtue in God's order. If we read verses 1 through 4 and we ask whether this future that he's describing is attainable or practical, we might as well just go home. Because if we subject this future to the standard of practicality, then we've already conceded everything. Because if some ambition or some future, some alternative way that the world could work, if it has to be practical, then the terms of what is possible in the world have already been set. Does that make sense? Or is it too early for that? So, last week, kind of toward the end, we got into a little bit of a rush, but I made the comment that, we talked about Adam Smith in his book, The Wealth of Nations, a classic text on how capitalism works. And he famously says that a capitalist system essentially works because of the greed and self-interest of the people involved. So the butcher produces a good product so that people will buy it. Not because he wants people to have meat, but because he wants their money. And if he produces a poor product, he's not going to get their money. And if he charges too high of a price, they're going to go to the other butcher. So he has to keep his price where it's competitive. He has to keep his product good enough, but he's trying to find the sweet spot where he'll maximize the amount of money that he's getting. Meanwhile, the consumer is trying to minimize the amount of money that they're spending. Again, because they're trying to get the most meat of the best quality for as little money as possible because of their own greed and self-interest. And it's because of the consumer's greed and because of the butcher's greed that they wind up finding this kind of sweet spot in the middle. And it's that whole thing, like that's how capitalism works. And what I said last week is, can we imagine a world where greed no longer has a place? What would the world even look like if people didn't act in self-interest? Okay, say more about that. So, but can we imagine if we could somehow take the human species and extract greed from it? I'll stop using the word self-interest. If we could extract greed from it, how would that change, just for starters, the economy? So, so his is the most practical. Okay. That is the world that we live in. Yeah, and I agree. It is the most practical system, and that is the world that we live in. The question is, can we imagine an alternative? A new heaven, a new earth. Yeah, exactly. You don't see it happening before then. So we think that the alternative, well, maybe I should stop trying to dig myself into a hole. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I thought I was going to ask at some point what the opposite of greed is, but maybe I decided not to. Since you brought it up, what is the opposite of greed? Is it generosity? I haven't thought through it, so I don't know. Maybe that's the answer. It sounds like a good answer. Yeah, I think we're probably primed now to hear what Micah has to say. I think we're deep enough into the woods now that this is going to make sense. Oh, I think a good start to that answer would be Micah 1 through 4, or Micah 4, 1 through 4. Because he's going to give us a world, he's going to imagine a world where the hearts of people have been transformed. Okay, let's just read it. Let's just read it. It shall come to pass in the latter days, again, we don't know how, we don't know when, but in God's faithfulness, this is going to happen, that the mountain of the house of the Lord, which, remember, just one verse earlier, is going to be plowed like a field. It'll be established as the highest of the mountains. It's the center of the world, basically. And it shall be lifted up above the hills, and peoples shall flow to it. And many nations shall say, come on, let's go on up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall decide disputes between many peoples. Who will? Who will decide many disputes? God will. And he shall decide disputes for strong nations far away. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. We'll pause there for now. So we could savor this. This is one of the great poems. This poem is so great that it's in the Bible twice. It's in Micah 4, and then it's also in Isaiah 2. Except Isaiah leaves out verse 4 about sitting under the vine and fig tree. But let me just note six elements of this alternative new reality. First of all, there's the reconstruction of Jerusalem. Most prophets, when they talk about this alternative, when they're trying to give people hope and trying to get them to imagine something new, the reconstruction of Jerusalem is part of it. Specifically, the reconstruction of the temple, because it's where God and humans meet. Second, all nations seek the Lord. It's not just Israel that's going to experience this newness and transformation. All the nations will. The Gentiles are going to seek the Lord. And the God of Israel is going to bless and redeem all the families of the earth, just like he promised Abraham. This is what Paul is arguing in Romans. Right? All the nations, many nations are going to come and they're going to say, let's go on up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. Because out of Zion shall go forth the law. The word law, anybody want to take a wild guess? What the Hebrew is? It's a word you know. Torah. The Torah is going to go out. The instruction of the Lord, the teaching of the Lord, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So when people learn Torah, this leads to moral transformation. Moral transformation through learning Torah. So Micah has this conviction that the world is always going to be broken, and the best we can do is the best we can do, and we're stuck with this practical system because this is just how the world works. Until the nations can let go of their pride and learn the wisdom that God wants to teach them. Now, I will say, next week, we're starting the summer teaching series. We're going to go through the book of Romans, which I've never taught through the book of Romans before, so I'm excited about Romans. I'm excited. Yeah. I'm jazzed. I am pumped. Some of you read the email. All right. And Paul, I think, is going to challenge or question this idea that simply having the Torah and studying the Torah can lead to moral transformation. The moral transformation, it really only comes by the work of the Spirit, which then leads to the question, like, well, what what advantage then has the Jew? What's the value of Torah? What's the value of circumcision? So we'll get to that. We're going to spend a good period of time on that. Fourth is the end of greed. It's not stated explicitly in the poem, but that's the point, especially in the context of everything that Micah says in the whole book. When the nations learn Torah, they're not going to be driven by greed anymore. And what happens when there's no more greed? They will no longer learn what? What does he say? At the end of verse 3. War. They're not going to need war anymore. The tools of war are turned into tools of agriculture. Things that kill are turned into things that give life. Which sounds to me kind of like death becomes resurrection. I mean, I'm not saying that this is the same caliber, but I'm hearing whispers of death leading to resurrection. Or death in chapter 3 leading to resurrection in chapter 4. Because in the cross, we see that the thing that was meant to bring death becomes the place where we receive life. The sword is being turned into a plowshare, so to speak. And then sixth, everybody has enough to eat. Every man sits under his own vine, under his own fig tree. Everyone has enough to eat. So, Jane asked a question about economics. How, if we could somehow extract greed, which I think is what Micah is imagining here, how would that change things? I think it would lead to the end of war and everyone having enough to eat. I'm no economist, but that seems to be what Micah says. 3 minutes left. Look at verse 5. For all the peoples walk each in the name of its God. Wait, hold on. Are we still talking about this future reality where all the nations are going to the temple to learn the Lord's Torah? If all the nations are walking in the name of their gods? It's a yes or no question. It doesn't sound like it, does it? It doesn't sound like it. The way I think we should read this is, but at the present, all the peoples walk each in the name of its God, but at the present, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Which is to say, for now, people walk in this way where the kings take bribes and the prophets preach for money and so on, but we, whoever we is, we are going to live in this future way. This new imagined reality of verses 1 through 4, that's the way of the Lord. That's the way that we're going to live. So it's a reality, a kingdom, a new creation that is not yet, but we're going to live as if it is already here. I think that verse 5 is a call to a new way of living in the world. I believe so. Living today as if heaven were already here. Because it is. Yeah. But we're not going to go on into Micah. We're done with Micah. You made it. You survived. The next week, we're going to start Romans. We're going to do Romans all through June, July, and August. And I am stoked. You're going to find all kinds of words. Jazzed. You like the word jazzed. For next week, read chapter 16. Chapter 16 for next week. Yes, the end. We're going to start at the end. Yeah, that little box. The question is not whether newness is practical, but whether it's imaginable. All right. Well, thank you, guys. I'm done.